July, sorry, last Sunday of July, and also last day of our three-part series that I've called Reflections on Anthropology, Bioethics, and Genetic Engineering. So far, we have barely mentioned genetic engineering, and so finally, we got to the day where we'll be talking about that. Disclaimer, there will be a bit of biology, so you're either very excited or very scared. That's what we'll try to think about today, genetic engineering specifically and Christian wisdom. What is genetic engineering? How do we navigate this topic? And grab some coffee if you'd like. I've grabbed mine. Let me pray for us and we'll continue. Father in heaven, thank you so much, Lord, for this day, for all those that are here today. Thank you for the privilege it has been to share on these current and important topics, Lord. And as we do so, we ask that you would bless us and help us to think your thoughts after you, to do this in a way that glorifies your name in light of your revealed truth in your word. Help us in that sense to honor your name and be witnesses of our Lord Jesus Christ in this day and age. And I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. All right. So I'd like to start just with a brief recap where we are so far. So lesson one, we talked about the theological concept of the image of God, right? The Christian view of man. And that led us to what I've called, what Dr. Egbert Skirman, which I've been referencing a lot, and he references this as the garden model, right? So on my right-hand side, this idea that in a Christian worldview, man is created in God's image and all of reality is given by God. God is the giver of meaning of reality. And so mankind's task is to tend and keep the garden, to work under God's rule, completely dependent on God, and to do so in a way that glorifies Him and that serves and loves our neighbor and cares for the creation God had made and given us. And so this is the garden model. And in this perspective, this Christian perspective, all technology and all culture and all science should be done from this perspective of humility, of servitude to God and to others, this ethics of tending and keeping. On the other hand, and this was what I tried to bring forth on lesson two, we have this other paradigm or this other model of fallen humanity, the Babel or the Babylonian model, right? We see ourselves because of sin as not dependent on God, but as autonomous creatures that do not rely on God. And in this model, all of reality turns into raw material that we are to control and shape according to our hearts. So just recall that in the narrative of the Tower of Babel, they were using technology, so bricks and mortar, and they were building a tower to make their names great. So under the Babel model, which we had argued is the environment our culture is seeped in, technology is developed to lord over reality so that we as humans can seek victory and salvation over the future by our own efforts and our own hands. And Dr. Skirman termed that view technicism, this idolatry of technology, and technology in a broad sense, not just digital technology. And so to put side by side, kind of comparing the two paradigms or worldviews we talked about, on one side we have the triune God as the foundation, on the other side we have that ultimately just matter and energy are all that is, this materialistic view. So on the biblical sense, reality is created, sustained, and its meaning is given by God. We are to work to uncover God's meaning and to serve Him. When on the technicistic worldview, all we have is raw material that we can shape and control according to our human reason. And this turns into different views of what man is. On one side, on the Christian view, man is the image of God. And one implication of that is that Each human being, each individual is unique in the eyes of God, and he is inviolable. He is worthy, not because he has certain characteristics, but because of the fact that he is the image of God. On the other hand, in the technicistic worldview, we see ourselves as self-declared lords, and we see each other as cogs in this larger machine that we can manipulate and control. And this leads to very different underlying motives or ethics behind science and technology. On the one hand, we as Christians should be seeking to glorify God, to love our neighbors, to tend and keep for creation. On the other, there are this utmost seeking of technical perfection and efficiency to bend everything according to our own desires, to seek victory over the future. And I try to flesh out a few implications to talk about bioethics. So as I mentioned, for the Christian, each human being is inviolable, has integrity, and creation itself has inherent value because the triune God made it. So even the smallest atom of creation is a product of God's creation. And so we approach that with humility, seeking to tend and care for it. While on the technicistic worldview, people are dehumanized. We are the image of God, but under this worldview, we are treated as something less than that. And I mentioned that how in that view, we start measuring an individual's worth on the terms of quality, like a product. And so if you don't reach a certain parameter of quality, you're either unfit or should be discarded. And that has several consequences when we deal with medical ethics, for instance. And so our conclusion, using the words of Egbert Skirman, was that in the technicistic worldview, man remains the measure of all things, while in the Christian view, the law of God, as manifestation of God's will and summed up in the two love commandments, continues to provide direction to all things. And his argument is that only through this Christian view, we can liberate technology and science from this idolatry and put it back to the place it should have as something good, as something given to us by God, but as something that should serve life, not lord over it. So this is the basic picture of where we are right now, these two clashing worldviews. And what does this have to do with genetic engineering? And I want to take a step back and ask the question, what is genetic engineering in the first place? When you think about genetic engineering, what comes to your mind? And so opening up for your thoughts. Designer babies, yeah. What else?
Cloning,
oh yeah, like Dolly the sheep that's cloned. Anything else?
Treating diseases.
Treating diseases, yeah. Well, several terms are sort of interchangeably used with genetic engineering. So people have used the words gene manipulation, gene cloning, recombinant DNA technology, genetic modification, has been called the new genetics. And we'll see it's a very broad field. It involves several different things. There's a really real way in which it is already completely surrounding us, and it's part of our daily lives. But the premise behind genetic engineering is that it's technology based in the idea that the genetic information, the information that we have encoded in the DNA molecule in our cells and arranged in the form of genes, is a resource. It's something that we can manipulate, edit, so to speak, in various ways to achieve certain goals, both in pure and applied science and medicine. And so notice how, yes, there is a sense, and we'll talk about this more, in which DNA is something that we are able to manipulate and edit. But there's a sense to it in which even this definition by this molecular biologist already starts to have overtones of technicism. It's a resource to be manipulated. Well, we can do that, but that's not all that it is, right? But that's the premise. And it's an integral part of our everyday life. Now, food industry experts estimate that over 70% of foods on the market have some sort of genetic engineering in their processing, and they're not needed to be labeled for it. So most likely, a lot of what we eat has been genetically engineered in some sense, right? So today, it's very common. We have genetically modified crops, such as pest-resistant corn or vitamin-enriched rice. If you're diabetic and you have to get insulin, the insulin you're getting comes from genetic engineering. We use the human insulin gene inserted into bacteria to produce that in a laboratory, and so that's genetically modified organisms making the medicine that saves lives. Personalized medicine, if you've taken those at-home DNA tests as well, there's genetic engineering technology involved in that. Today, for decades now, we've been producing transgenic, and this word transgenic means, so trans across, when you insert genes from one species into another. So we make transgenic animals for food and pharmaceutical production. We make genetically modified mice to have models to develop drugs in laboratories. What else? They've been engineering microbes and algae to make biofuels, to clean up waste, to make biomaterials. And on the more concerning side, too, today it's routine in places like the U.S., for instance, if you're doing in vitro fertilization, to screen the embryos before implanting them into the mother. And then that's genetic engineering technology used for that. That's what they call PGD. And then they would select the one that's the best to put in the mother and develop. And now we have research using also gene editing in embryos as well. So very comprehensive part of our life today. Yeah?
Changing the genetic dynamics of those products, but not in a lab at the gene level.
So there is a sense in which the examples you gave, we wouldn't classify them as genetic engineering. So those are just hybridizations or crosses. But naturally, there is genetic engineering naturally. So for instance, bacteria can naturally sometimes acquire resistance to antibiotics, because one strain of bacteria that's resistant will give part of its genes to another strain. And so in nature, it does happen, this what they call horizontal gene transfer. So different species, usually in microorganisms, but even amongst plants and simple invertebrates. And viruses do this as well. So there is this transfer of genetic material. The difference in this case is that it's humans taking the control, basically, and seeking to apply this to our own interests rather than it happen by itself. That's the basic difference. So we're sort of harnessing something that happens in nature and increasing it exponentially and applying it to our own purposes. Now, when it happens in nature, sometimes things go wrong, and there's diseases that happen with that. And there's a sense in which when we think we can simply control this, there are things that can happen too. And the question I want to raise is, how far can we go in implementing this, which is what I want to discuss at the end. But that's a good point. There's a sense in which genetic engineering happens naturally to a certain degree. And perhaps I'm saying all of this, and you're like, yeah, but I still don't know what that is. Okay, you're ready. Now, I don't know, I don't want to point fingers or anything, but there's people here that are older than genetic engineering. It's a very recent field. And it really started to pick up with these two guys. So if you're here and you took biology with me, you know their names, and they're also there, right? James Watson and Francis Crick working on figuring out what the shape of the DNA molecule is and how it works. And all these discoveries into the fact that DNA, which stands for deoxyribonucleic acid, is the molecule in living things that serves as the hard drive for the information in the cell. It's what carries or stores biological information. And what Crick, Watson and Crick realized is that this molecule, which is a double helix made with these building blocks called nucleotides, we represent by letters, carries information just like letters in a written language. So this is Crick's sequence hypothesis. Right? As chemist Michael Polanyi states, the configuration in DNA must be physically indeterminate as the sequence of words is on a printed page. So what's the idea? Just like we humans can store information by writing down a specific sequence of letters on a piece of paper, and it's the given arrangement of letters that encodes information, it's the exact same thing in DNA. It's instead of a 20-something letter alphabet, depending on where you are in the world, it's a four-letter alphabet, but the specific order of these letters making up the molecule encodes for specified information. And this is really amazing, right? Because now this is a parenthesis here. Where does information come from? Natural processes by themselves cannot create these kinds of language-like information. It's really screaming at us that, you know, God created life because information is at the foundation of life. And just another caveat, this means that all scientists, Christian or not, when they're dealing with nature and where they're dealing with biology, it's God's revelation in front of them and around them. So you either recognize that or you're either rebelling against that. But that's the basic idea. The DNA is this hard drive of information in the cell, and it functions just like human language. Now, to develop this further, getting human beings as an example, there's about 10 trillion cells or ish in your body. So that's basically what you're made of biologically, 10 trillion cells. Almost all of your cells, if you were to get one of them, has a nucleus, which is a central organelle, has an envelope, and inside the nucleus you would have DNA. And this DNA is organized into chromosomes. Now, human beings have how many chromosomes? 46, so 23 pairs. 44 chromosomes plus two sex chromosomes, X and Y if you're a boy, XX if you're a girl, 46 in total. A chimpanzee, for instance, has 48 chromosomes, right? And you know, there's insects that have only two. There's a wide variety. Humans, 46. So inside each human cell, inside the nucleus, there are 46 DNA molecules packed up in what we call chromosomes. And each of these chromosomes is basically a large DNA molecule. And within this DNA molecule, there are segments of the molecule that we call genes. So genes are these units of inheritance. And I'm going to use an analogy here, but think of genes as specific recipes. So each gene contains a specific sequence of those letters encoding a specific kind of information. Here's my analogy. Inside each of your cells, there's a library, the nucleus. And Lydia knows what I'm talking about because I've used this analogy over and over again in class. In a library, you have several books. So these are DNA molecules packed up as chromosomes. In each book, you have pages with recipes, the genes. And that's all stored in the library, in the nucleus, in the form of DNA. Now, if you want to use those recipes to make something like an omelet, you got to choose a specific book, open it, go to the recipe you want. You transcribe the recipe into a form that you can remove from the library and take to your kitchen. And then you follow the instructions and cook an omelet. In the cell, basically the same thing happens. You have DNA stored in the nucleus, the form of chromosomes, which are books with genes, the recipes. The cell wants to use or express a given gene. It will transcribe it into a form of another class of molecules called RNA, ribonucleic acid. Don't matter, the details won't be that important right now. And then it can read that and express that into a protein or other, or there are other kinds of DNA too, but this is the simplified version of it that they've called the central dogma of molecular biology. But what's the point? What I want to say here is that at the core of living things, you have these DNA molecules storing recipes, the genes, and it's encoded in a way that's very similar to human language. So imagine this recipe here. Boom. Omelet recipe, 4 eggs, 2 tablespoons of cream, 1 tablespoon of butter, salt to taste. Pretty nice, right? Now, small change. 4 eggs, 20 tablespoons of cream, 1 tablespoon of butter, salt to taste. Would it be the same tasty omelet? So imagine I have 2 cats. Sometimes they like to walk over my keyboard. Let's say they walked over my keyboard and inserted an extra zero there in the recipe. It's going to change the product. Same thing happens in DNA. As DNA is replicated for your cells to divide and you grow, and there's also environmental factors and radiation and McDonald's, all that can lead to, I shouldn't say brands here, right, but that's okay, can lead to certain errors in the copying of DNA. And those errors that we call mutation are like in certain variations, changes in our recipe, which can have no effect, little effect, or depending how it happens, large-scale effects, like genetic diseases. So a few examples, right? A few recipes in the human genome. You have the gene for insulin, very important for your sugar metabolism. So imagine a recipe, about 1,400 letters there. Changes in that recipe, mutations in that gene can cause, for instance, problems with your sugar metabolism. Or a very large gene that we have is for the protein called dystrophin, which helps anchor your muscle cells. So 2,400,000 letters making up this recipe. Mutations, so errors that can happen and can be inherited, can lead, for instance, to muscular dystrophy, which is a very serious genetic disease. And so notice how mutations are sort of bugs in the code, in the recipes, and lead to problems. Okay, and how did we get to genetic engineering? A very brief history, I'm just going to skim over. Any questions so far? Does the analogy of the books and recipes sort of make sense? Okay. Yeah. Yeah, the recipes are the genes. They contain information to make different proteins and products. Yeah.
But the recipe is not protein.
The recipe is in the DNA. It's the segments that we call genes in the DNA.
To say which proteins
to make, yes, basically. Very good. So, genetics really starts in the early 1900s with discovery of Gregor Mendel's work. But notice how this is a recent field. 1944, at the early 20th century, we didn't really know that DNA was the carrier of genetic information. That's only in the 40s that we figure out. And then in the 1950s, we discover that what DNA looks like and start discovering how it works. But the tools that will allow us to manipulate DNA come from the 60s and 70s. So in the 60s, we discover this molecular glue that we can use to attach pieces of DNA together. 1966, we decipher the genetic code, which is how the information in DNA is read and decoded. And in 1970, we discover, we have the glue, we also have now the scissors that allow us to make cuts at specific regions of DNA. And so this starts allowing scientists to really get DNA molecules, cut them and rearrange them and create new combinations, so to speak. So in 1972, Stanford University, that's the first like hallmark. So notice how genetic engineering is recent. Really from the 70s, they start becoming routine. And today it's routine in all molecular biology laboratories here at Covenant High School. If you take advanced biology, we do what we call bacterial transformation, which is sort of genetic engineering. We get E. coli bacteria, we introduce into them genes from jellyfish, and they glow green, and it's pretty cool. It's not going to have an outbreak and kill anyone. It's just fun to do. But today, or this decade, or last decade, since 2010-ish, really, there's been another revolution in the field of genetic engineering, which is not only the discovery, but the application of what has been called a CRISPR technology. So far, the technology that we had up to this point allowed us to manipulate DNA, but there's a sense in which it wasn't as precise. But today, we are at a new era of precision and being able to make those manipulated changes in a more precise and directed way. So I have a short video here. It's just 15 minutes. Oh, I'm just kidding. It's just like 2 minutes. That's going to give us an overview of what I'm talking about. This would be the hallmark today of like the forefront of what we can do with genetic engineering. Jennifer Doudna from Cornell University, if I'm not mistaken, awarded the Nobel Prize for this in 2020.
In a document, if we suspect we've misspelled a word, we can use the find function to highlight the error and correct it or delete it. Within our DNA, that function is taken on by a system called CRISPR-Cas9. CRISPR is short for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats. CRISPR consists of two components, the Cas9 protein that can cut DNA and a guide RNA that can recognize the sequence of DNA to be edited. To use CRISPR-Cas9, scientists first identify the sequence of the human genome that's causing a health problem. Then they create a specific guide RNA to recognize that particular stretch of A's, T's, G's, and C's in the DNA. The guide RNA is attached to the DNA cutting enzyme Cas9. And then this complex is introduced to the target cells. It locates the target letter sequence and cuts the DNA. At that point, scientists can then edit the existing genome by either modifying, deleting, or inserting new sequences. It effectively makes CRISPR-Cas9 a cut and paste tool for DNA editing. In the future, scientists hope to use CRISPR-Cas9 to develop critical advances in patient care, or even cure lifelong inherited diseases.
Now, this video is like, I want to say 7 years old. We're already doing this, right? Just a little bit of background. CRISPR is a system that was found in bacteria. It's a part of a bacterial immune system. So a lot of the greatest enemies of bacteria, of course, are certain viruses that insert their DNA into the bacteria, hijack the bacteria to make more copies of them. These systems, some bacteria have them to fight off this viral DNA, and we have harnessed that because it allows us to, it's able to recognize specific DNA sequences, and we now harnessed it to be able to make precise changes to DNA in our interest. So it really allows for precise editing of the genome. So just as an example, and then I'll open for some questions so far, make sure we're on the same page. But let's say there's an original sequence. The dog saw the cat sit and the fox run. Notice how each word is three letters, because in DNA too, it's three-letter arrangements that give the words, so to speak, in the gene. Now, let's say you smoke a lot, and then mutations happen, and there's a mutated sequence, or perhaps a problem in producing gametes during cell division. You're born with an inherited change, a mutation, and now what's supposed to be this reads, the dog saw the cat sit and the fox run. This is the simplest kind of mutation you can have, which is just changing one letter. There are mutations where you insert extra letters, where you delete some letters, where you, there's just something that really can mess it up, so to speak. This would be the simplest one. What CRISPR allows us to do today effectively is to identify the B and add it back to a D. That's pretty cool. Questions so far? Is it all sort of making sense?
Is this on the test?
Yes, so there will be a quiz after. You have to be able to say what the acronym CRISPR means. That's like the hallmark. Okay, so what are we using this for today? So for instance, there's research in animal models where this CRISPR system has been able to either correct or, I'm not going to go into what exon skipping is, but effectively treat this very serious kind of genetic disease called Duchenne muscular dystrophy. It's been studied to be applied to inactivating genes related to very serious neurological diseases like Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS, Stephen Hawking, or Huntington's disease, which is another deadly genetic disease. And this is a dominant inherited disease. So if you have the mutated gene for Huntington's disease, you will develop it. And there's a 50% chance your kids will develop it. And it's late onset, and it's very, very tragic, and it's deadly. And so applying this to these serious genetic diseases. Chromosome editing. So this all in laboratories, right? But for instance, Down syndrome is caused by having part of an extra or full extra copy of a given chromosome, chromosome 21. And in theory, with these systems, we could remove or silence that extra chromosome and prevent some of the consequences of Down syndrome. They've been studying applying it in cancer immunotherapy, so engineering immune cells that would be able to target cancer more effectively. It's already being applied for sickle cell disease, which would allow... So far it was a disease without a cure, a genetic disease. It's being applied to treat sickle cell disease. And it's also being studied, and there are already experiments where they're applying this technology not in an adult or a child, but at the embryo stage of development. And this has been prompting a lot of ethical debates, because if you edit an embryo, then you basically the entire person will have that genetic modification that will be passed on to their offspring. And so it's something, you're basically changing the lives of people generations from now, and they weren't there to sign off the waiver or anything, and so there's sort of ethical questions with that. This is the forefront of genetic engineering and its applications to medicine today. And it's very powerful because, I mean, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, Lou Gehrig's disease, Huntington's disease, sickle cell anemia, these are horrible diseases. Tay-Sachs disease, horrible diseases. So far, we haven't really been able to do anything about them except try to alleviate symptoms, and now we're able to, in theory at least, seek a cure. That's very powerful. But what are some concerns? Well, there's a concern of editing the wrong place in DNA. Doesn't matter how precise it is, there's always a degree of uncertainty. And the problem is, if you edit the wrong place, then to unedit that, it's a whole headache, you know. Permanent effects would ensue. There's also unknown long-term effects. This is something we've been doing the past decade or so, or even more recently. We don't know what this will mean decades from now, because genes don't work just individually, but there's a sense in which the whole context of the genome influences, genes affect other genes. We are not sure yet of how all those interactions work, and there's a fear that making even a small change could lead to ripple effects in ways that we wouldn't be able to foresee. right? And so this could mean unforeseen consequences for the lives of people. There's also the risk of whole genome changes. So instead of making these precision changes, changing large chunks of your DNA or changing whole chromosomes, and also the risk of unintended or harmful outcomes. There are immune reactions that you could have to the tools used and to the delivery mechanisms, and a lot of ethical concerns as well, especially with editing embryos, which has been done. So we have questions of enhancement. So instead of identifying a disease and seeking to cure it, perhaps we want to make people that are resistant to diseases, or perhaps we want to make people that are a little bit taller, a little bit smarter, a little bit, you know, more Brazilian-looking, perhaps. enhancement, right? So it's a little bit tricky there. There's, you know, problems with consent. An embryo is not consenting to the treatment. If it's something that's inherited, the future generations are not consenting to that. And of course, eugenics is at the forefront. Now, eugenics is something that happens today, right? One thing is to prevent diseases in people. Another is to prevent people with diseases, which would be eugenics. So for instance, in certain countries, basically eradicated Down syndrome because they identify it and they abort those babies, and that's eugenics. And then applying genetic engineering to eliminate certain characteristics that are deemed undesirable also opens a whole sort of ethical Pandora's box. And it's interesting to think about this, a very powerful technology, something unlike anything that we have ever seen. Why is this so, raises so much concerns? Because we're now able to make edits to DNA, this at a pretty precise way. This is a revolution in biology. It opens a whole sort of box. And if you're applying this from a technicistic worldview, that, for instance, would see human beings merely as products of their DNA, that it's okay to manipulate and edit them to achieve our own goals, then you can see how that would lead to really dire consequences. And so the fear of eugenics, for instance, is at the forefront there as well. Yes?
I'm a little confused as to when you would edit. Let's say it's Down's as opposed to ALS, and it's already at conception there. Well, so is the ALS in a sense, but it doesn't manifest till later. When would you do something to change that? Or can you?
Yeah, so there are applications that they've been doing that after. I'm not sure if in utero, but applications I've seen are after birth. So for instance, for sickle cell anemia or for CPS1, which I mentioned, they're specifically targeting that, let's say, the part where the mutation is affecting. And I'll mention those examples. So you can apply this after you're born in the more specific way. The question is, for some of these diseases, ideally, you would want to apply them earlier. Perhaps even you could apply them combining it with in vitro fertilization and ensuring that the embryo wouldn't have a certain disease. So it could be applied in all of those stages, but the magnitude of the effect will be different. If you're applying it later on, it's much more focused and the effect is much more contained. So perhaps you could try to edit it after a person is born and prevent some of the negative consequences, but then you're not necessarily curing it depending on what the disease is. But it's really a case-by-case thing. It really depends on the disease. In these studies here, these are still happening in very early laboratory studies with culture cells and stuff like that. They're not applying this to human embryos yet. But going over some of the literature, it seems like there is a willingness in scientific community that if we achieve a certain degree of precision, it would be okay to to apply this to embryos if it's preventing these bad diseases, right?
You have to test every embryo bit to catch it early enough, right?
Yeah, you would test the parents and see if the parents carry it, and then we already do genetic testing a lot, and so I guess that opens a whole other box of things as well.
So does every cell in the human body have the same copy of DNA?
Yes. So there's all cells in your body, mostly, like your blood cells as they're working, they don't have their nucleus anymore, but all cells in your body have the same DNA content, so they have all the same books, but not all the books are being read in all your cells. So that's why cells in your brain are different than cells in your skin. Your DNA, there are parts of it that are shut off and shut on, depending on where you are. The applications that have been applied, for instance, if you have sickle cell anemia, you have that mutation in all your cells, but it really is only being expressed in the cells that are creating your blood cells in your bone marrow. And so that's where you would make the change.
You have to edit every blood cell, not necessarily.
Or you would edit the bone marrow that would then make blood, yeah.
But you're still not editing all
of
it.
No. Yeah, yeah. So in this sense, it's focused on that specific organ. Yes?
I'm trying to wrap my head around CRISPR.
Yeah.
When I have done reading on genetically modified crops in the past, they had to inject bacteria. Like if I wanted to develop a tomato, they had to inject bacteria into the DNA in order to weaken the genetic material in order then so that it would accept the new genetic material. Has CRISPR made that a defunct method? If I wanted to make a tomato, could I just go in and, you know, cut and paste DNA?
Well, that's one of the big... one of the big applications would be, so for it would be much easier to make modified crops, for instance. And so it would effectively mean it's much easier and much more precise than these previous methods, and it would be much easier to get the intended effect that you want to make, let's say an enriched crop or a pest resistance crop. Yeah, so you would just change the... So that's another thing, too. There's this idea that depending on how you would apply it, for instance, with some kinds of crops, you're not inserting DNA from another species, but you're editing the DNA of that species. So there's a sense in which that might be better, perhaps. And it is... There are a lot of gray areas, and it is a case-by-case basis on how we think about these issues. But just notice how this opens a lot of questions and boxes and possibilities too. Now, how do we apply Christian wisdom? And I understand I don't have a lot of time, so how do we do this with genetic engineering? Let me skip this one. Right? Should we just outright reject it or just get very excited and embrace it wholesale? And there is a sense, and depending on what we talk about, if we're talking about genetically engineering bacteria, for instance, microorganisms, it's much less controversial because, you know, bacteria is only one cell. The effects are much more manageable. It's something we do in a lab. It's less unintended. There are less unintended consequences. But when we start talking about plants that will then have the possibility of being released into the wild or animals or human beings, then there are more ethical concerns. And when we're talking about plants, animals, and especially human beings, the approach that Dr. Skirman uses is to apply an ethical principle called no unless. And what does he mean? Well, he argues that from a biblical perspective, we don't need genetic engineering to solve our problems. So our default stance, applying it to plants, animals, and humans, should be no, And what he's saying here is we ought to be responsible and we ought to exercise caution. It's a very powerful technology. So let's take a default position of, okay, let's try not to do this unless, well, and he says, it is a sense in which it's already around us. It's inevitable. So unless there's a real good reason for doing it and doing it in a responsible way. So no, unless we have a really good reason and we do it responsibly. And so how do we draw the line? So for instance, if we're talking about human beings, should we apply genetic engineering to human beings? Well, in human beings, the case where the no would be much more stronger because dealing with the image of God. Where would the unless come in? Well, is there a real medical need? Is the motivation healing or control? Does it respect human dignity? Would this change be necessary if the world were not fallen? So are we trying to just improve things or are we trying to heal effects from the fall or diseases? And then, very important, he argues, does it zero in on a specific problem at the organic level or we're changing an entire person's constitution? So applying it to human beings, his idea would be, no, we don't do it. If we're considering doing it, it has to be for a very good reason, for healing, and zeroed in specific at an organic level. So treating a specific affected organ, not the entire person, because that would be, you know, there's just so many risks, and we're dealing with the image of God that would be problematic, right? So this contrast between healing and enhancement. Let me end with two examples, perhaps, that will help. And I know that there are much more I could bring and discuss, but I'm focusing on the case of human beings here. So, for instance, editing body cells, somatic cells, to cure genetic diseases. There's the case for sickle cell disease and beta thalassemia that has already been applied. So what are they doing in these cases? People born with these genetic diseases, after they're born, they would get their bone marrow cells, so it's just a specific part of their body. They would treat the bone marrow cells with the CRISPR technology to, in this case, induce the production of fetal hemoglobin, which counteracts the effect of the disease. And then you put that back into the person, and then they would be able to be treated for that genetic disease. So notice how it's something that without this technology, there would be no really effective treatment, and it zeroes in on a problem, and it only focuses at the organic level. Sorry? No, after you're born. Same thing here with, this is the example I brought on the first lesson of KJ, which was born with an inborn error of metabolism called CPS1, a deadly genetic disease. After he was born and the doctors identified the problem, they developed the genetic engineering treatment and they only treated his liver cells, not treating, for instance, his entire body or something that would affect his germline, his reproduction, and it would be passed on. And he was so far been doing good. So what do you think? Yes or no? It seems like in this case, the unless would be a good application. Like, we want to be careful, but these are diseases that there are no other ways of treating. It zeroes in on the problem. It doesn't affect the whole of the person's constitution. It's not something inherited. Perhaps we can consider this carefully, and where the people are doing this are being responsibilized for what they do. So that's a nicer scenario, perhaps, where we can see this as a blessing if we use it very carefully. On the other hand, there's recently the CRISPR baby scandal where a scientist in China genetically added 3 human embryos so that they would be born with a mutation that would, in theory, make them resistant to HIV. And he was scolded by the scientific community, but the research with embryos also happens in the US, not just in China. But we could think about, well, what if What about this case, right? He is editing the embryo beforehand so that it's born resistant to a disease, weighing the no, but unless. It seems like in this case, the no would be much more, because you're not zeroing in on a given problem. Embryos cannot give consent. You're changing the whole genetic constitution. You're manipulating an image of God as it was a product. And there are unforeseen consequences, right? The scientists are afraid that these genetically edited babies could have then actually susceptibility to other diseases that were unintended. But then we could think, well, what about if someone has Tay-Sachs disease or Huntington's disease? Could we edit an embryo that's identified with these deadly, horrible genetic diseases, if it is for such a good reason? With the framework we're proposing here, the no would probably still be the case, because we want to zero in on the problem. We don't want to tinker with and treat the image of God as a product. And so, just so we can have perhaps time for questions, what I'm trying to argue here is that we should not adjust ourselves uncritically to any and all prevailing trends in science and technology, but we should seek to understand it under this paradigm that we ought to be responsible before God and treating man as God's image, tending and caring for creation. And there's a real sense in which all of these problems are ultimately caused by sin. And there's a real sense in which all of these problems have already been solved on the cross. And one day, there will be no more. And so if that is our hope, then we're not relying on this as our hope. The problem is scientists that don't have that are relying on this as our hope. So we ought to bring this perspective of responsibility and careful Christian wisdom in dealing with these topics. That's what I wanted to share. I know it took a little bit long, and there's much more that could be said. Perhaps can open for a couple questions or commentaries. Hopefully this is food for thought, and there's much more to think about. Owen.
How accessible is CRISPR to general society?
Like, you're talking about cost?
I'm
not sure. I would say it's probably very expensive. That's another concern, too. You'd have rich people that can do that, and then people with less means, they wouldn't have access to that technology. And there's societal consequences, too, for that.
Machines are automated. They're available widely.
Really?
You can buy used, not from CRISPR, but you can buy, for instance, used DNA and RNA sequencers that
mm-hmm.
will allow you
yeah.
to...
Yeah.
But the CRISPR technology is becoming more and more widespread. These machines are highly automated, and they're not that big.
Yeah, there's a sense in which this is happening so fast, and the trend is to become more and more available too, I suppose. Yeah.
Let's say HIV or Tay-Sachs, expensive is it to get a gene therapy as opposed to having medications and therapies for a child all the rest of their life?
Well, that's a good question. I don't have a figure for you, but the idea is that as this becomes cheaper, it would be cheaper to just treat and zero in on the problem than spending a lifetime having to rely on healthcare for that. The problem would be tinkering with the entirety of a person, and that's the ethical consequences.
Is it something that's available now?
For some limited applications, it's starting to become available, the CRISPR technology, like for sickle cell anemia, but it's still very much happening, the research. It's very recent.
Sherman?
This?
And,
some of this technology has already been developed, and we're talking about the embryos. You can do this to the embryos. One of the elephants in the room is the only way, you know, when you first start doing this to embryos, they die.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about babies.
Mm-hmm.
We call them embryos.
Yeah.
Because that's much more palatable for all of us.
Yeah.
Except as the church, one of our advocacy should be that it's not okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's basically human experimentation, what we would say. So, yeah, that's...
So developing that technology, so I think my point is, like, the church should be, if we're using Sherman's, part of it should be that we're not okay with the technology being developed.
At least in those applications, yes. I would agree. Because, we're dealing with human beings, with human lives, and... Again, I think it's very good what he says, treating it as a product and then manipulating, and then if it doesn't match, you discard. It's just, you're not treating it as the image of God. Isaac.
How do you draw the line between restoration and enhancement? You know, in your example of sickle cell, you're restoring function that is broken. But say someday this technology advances and then receiving this,
mm-hmm.
You can build muscle more easily. You can
design your blood.
Right.
Yeah.
It has other benefits tied to it. So if you have sickle cell, then the answers in our brain are just get it because you're restoring, and then you may have some extra benefits. But if you don't have it, you could still get those benefits. So how do you draw the line between restoration of a broken function and enhancement?
Yeah. And I think it's not easy to draw that line, and it is a case-by-case thing. That's why I like how he is very cautious about it. Like, okay, let's take a step back and say no first, and then see if we have very good reason for doing it. Identifying that, I think, in a sense, requires us to have this idea that bringing a Christian worldview, that creation is normative, right? God creates and upholds entirety of creation, and these creational norms, there's a sense in which we can discover them by studying science. And so I think there's a sense in which we do need to identify what's the problem, what's the proposal, and really go deep and seeing is this what would be like the wild type human factor, or are we trying to make something extra? But there is a sense in which I think we cannot escape the ethics and then the worldview and then bringing our Christianity into play and just being advocates for this responsibility and the idea of God's image. I'm not sure I answered your question, but that's how I think. It's case by case. We ought to study the biology and really think hard about it, but there it's inevitable that we will bring our Christian perspective to bear, even trying to translate it into technical terms, but as we've been trying to do, but I think we cannot escape that idea of normativity and of creation, in a sense. And perhaps last question.
I think you could probably use the way we think about current medicine and drugs to think about this issue.
Yeah.
Like, I think of ADHD supplements, like Adderall, for instance. Like, if you take it and you have ADHD, it helps you tremendously focus and restores your brain to
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, most of my college professors took Adderall just to be able to stay up all night working on papers, and that's certainly not restoring. And yeah.
It's the same with this gene editing. You can use it just as a super effective medicine, or you
can use it to create two. Yeah. And it's interesting, just a commentary on that. I was trying to read papers on the ethics of CRISPR, and it's interesting that they don't really have a framework. Like, where they limit themselves to describing different concerns and scenarios and saying, well, perhaps if in the future it'll be okay to do this or that. They don't have a foundation to adjudicate ethics. Christianity provides a foundation to adjudicate ethics. So I think it's important that sense of a gospel witness in this area as well, as we get ourselves involved out there and work on this. So let me pray, and I'll be more than happy to talk to you afterwards. Hopefully this is food for thought and stimulating and instigating. Let me pray. Father Almighty, thank you so much for this day and for everyone that was able to be here, Lord. I hope this was edifying. Help us, Lord, as we think about these topics, to do so in a way that honors your name, your word, and that witnesses to the world that you are God, creator of heaven and earth, that you give us everything, that we rely on you. So help us, we ask, in Jesus' name. Amen.